This is Melba Smith speaking with Eric Jewell, 1109 Converse Court, Rock Springs, Wyoming. The date is February 12, 1992. Eric, are you a native of Rock Springs?
Yes, I was born in Rock Springs. I was born in the old hospital. My dad was born in Rock Springs. He was born at home. My brother was born in the same house. That was 514 B Street. The house is still there. But I was born in the hospital.
Who were your grandparents then?
Okay. My grandfather Jewell was Christopher Jewell, and he migrated to the United States from Norway in the 1800s. And I have a book here that's all written in Norwegian, but I can decipher some of it. He moved to the United States in about 1886, I believe. He was my grandfather on my father's side, from whom I derive my last name. His wife was the daughter of the first mayor of Rock Springs, who was William O'Donnell. William O'Donnell was Irish, and I presume that my grandmother was also Irish, my great-grandmother, I should say. William O'Donnell came from Wisconsin, and his wife originated in New York. William O'Donnell was employed by the Union Pacific Railroad back in the days, and was in Rock Springs at the time of the Chinese Revolution. And he befriended the Chinese. He was on the Chinese side to the point that he left Rock Springs on a fast train, headed east for a while, and then came back because of the unrest and everything in the town against the Chinese miners, and the fact that he was their friend. Some of my aunts still have some things that were given to their grandfather, William O'Donnell, by the Chinese, some Chinese vases. Are you familiar with the Chinese game Mahjong?
I don't think so.
They have a game, a Chinese game called Mahjong, that has a lot of little blocks made of bamboo and faced with ivory with symbols and so on. I remember playing with them when I was a child. We used to play the game when I was a child. They still have that.
That's interesting.
They have one vase that I remember, and I'm not sure at this place in time who has it, but it was a Chinese vase, and I have been told that it was quite valuable, but it dated back to that time, and the Chinese people in Rock Springs gave it to my great-grandfather, William O'Donnell, as a friendship thing, because he befriended them.
That's very interesting.
He was an interesting fellow. It was an interesting period in time. I've been told, and I have no documentation to back it up, my great-grandmother, O'Donnell, came to Rock Springs. She originated in New York, but when she came to Rock Springs, the Union Pacific Railroad was built only to Point of Rocks. They went by rail to Point of Rocks and came on to Rock Springs in a horse and wagon.
Your grandfather, Christopher Jewell, when he came, why did he come to this part of the country?
Well, I presume that it was probably for the economic opportunity offered in America. When he left Norway, he left with an older brother, and they went to South America. Prior to his leaving Norway, he worked as a merchant seaman. He was a sailor. They moved to Argentina, and he didn't like it there. He didn't care for the climate, nor the politics, nor the atmosphere at all. And he wanted to come to the United States, but his older brother had the money. And he said, no, we're going to stay here. And my grandfather said, well, I'm not going to stay here. I'm going to the United States. So he worked his way as a seaman on a ship to the United States, and I believe he landed in Boston. This was where he lived when he first came to the United States. He landed in Boston, and of course he couldn't speak English. But he went by one day. He was unemployed and would work at anything where he could make a dollar to take care of himself, and he saw a dry goods store window, and in it they had some mannequins and a display, and he looked at it, and it wasn't very artistically done. He had worked in that profession some in Norway before he became a seaman. I believe the seaman thing was mainly as a means to get from Norway to somewhere else, but he had had some prior experience in Norway in the dry goods business. So he went into this store and asked the manager if he could rearrange the display. And the manager told him, go ahead and see. So he did, and the manager liked it and hired him. So he worked for about a year in Boston. Then he moved to, where was it? I believe it was St. Paul, but let me look here in my Norwegian book where he moved to. He went to St. Paul, Minnesota, and from St. Paul, I believe he was employed in St. Paul in a similar business, and he wasn't there too long. Then he came to Rock Springs. He came here. It was kind of odd. He was working in St. Paul, and he read an article in a newspaper advertising for a store clerk or manager for a business in Rock Springs, Wyoming, who could speak Finn. Now, he spoke the Norse language, which was used and still is to some extent in Norway, Sweden, and Denmark. The language there is rather similar to our English as compared with the United States, England, and Australia. Differences, colloquial expressions, accents, and so on, but if you could understand, if you could speak it in Norway, you could understand the Swedes and the Danes and so on. So he felt that since he knew the Norse, and Finland is of course attached to Norway on the upper end, that probably he could speak Finn too, that they probably also spoke Norse. So he applied for the job from St. Paul, and they told him to come. Well, of course, when he reached Rock Springs, he couldn't speak Finn any better than he could speak Greek. And because the Finn language is not related to the other Norse languages in any manner at all. For that matter, Finn isn't related to any other language on the face of the earth. It's a unique language in itself. But they liked him, and he got along well with the people, and at that time, there were a lot of Finlanders employed in the coal mines in Rock Springs. He got along well, then eventually he worked as the manager for that store, eventually got into a store business of his own, then got involved with some relatives that people who had married sisters of his wife's, and they got into the sheep business. And He was one of the early people involved in the Northside State Bank. To what degree, I don't really know. I've been told that he was at one time one of the early presidents of the Northside State Bank. And I called today to ask down there if they knew anything about that. And Christian Bunning, they're going to ask Christian if he can recall any of that history or find it out. And when I get that information, I'll let you know if it's of interest to you.
I appreciate that.
In the ranching business, my grandfather, Jewel, did a number of things. He early, prior to World War I, he started a farm up at Elkhorn. To get water for that farm, he had a section of land there, but it wasn't close to any live stream. It was not too far from Little Sandy, but no way to get the water up at that particular location. So he engineered a ditch that comes out of the Little Sandy River, not too far above the upper Bill Thompson Ranch, what used to be the Bill Thompson. That ditch crosses the Continental Divide in that area, not too far from where it leaves, several miles from where it leaves Little Sandy. It crosses the Continental Divide onto the Atlantic drainage. And it runs for a distance of about 5 or 6 miles, then recrosses the Continental Divide back to the Pacific drainage. It's one of three man-made ditches in the United States that cross the Continental Divide twice. This was done prior to any legislation against such a thing. Today, in order to do that, would require an act of Congress. But this was done prior to that time. The ditch is still there and is still in operation. We still use it. We take water from Little Sandy, which is in the Pacific watershed, put it into Lander Creek, which is a tributary of the Sweetwater, and ultimately on down into the Atlantic watershed.
Did your grandfather homestead that land?
I don't know how he came by it. There was a full section of land there that we held deed to.
I see.
When we sold out of the ranching business back in the 50s, 320 acres of that was sold to the Magagna brothers, Edwin and Dolph Magagna. Jim Magagna presently owns it. My family still owns 320 acres there. We don't farm it. We don't make any attempt to put water on it. The water that we run down that way, and we still run water in that ditch, we have adjudicated water right for it. We run down there solely for the purpose at this time of providing water for the sheep. The ditch makes use of some natural waterways. Mitchell Slough, you're familiar with?
Yes.
This ditch, after it crosses the Continental Divide the second time, dumps into the upper end of Mitchell Slough, and runs down through Mitchell Slough, then goes by man-made ditch again from Mitchell Slough over to the location where this old farm used to be. After World War I, the Eden Valley Project was developed, and you would recall when that started. I don't know the dates, but at that time, then my grandfather bought farmland in Eden Valley, and they pretty much abandoned the farming operation at Elkhorn because it was so remote. Especially so in those days, winters were hard and long, and they had only horses for transportation, and it was too remote. They used to winter cattle there. They grew good crops there, and they wintered the cattle there, but it was too remote. So when the Eden Valley Project opened up, my grandfather bought land in Eden Valley and established a farm there, and they pretty much let they no longer tried to farm the land at Elkhorn.
I see. Now, your dad and mother, how long did But of course, you said your dad was born here in Rock Springs. And your mother, now who was she?
My mother was, her maiden name was Jones, Helen Edith Jones. She was raised in Rocky Ford, Colorado. Her parents came to Colorado from Illinois. And I don't really know too much about them back in those days, other than my grandfather Jones was a farmer in Illinois, in Montgomery County, Illinois. They moved to Rocky Ford and farmed there for many years. My grandfather Jones raised cantaloupe for seed, and the seed was shipped to the Imperial Valley in California, which was just starting at that time. They couldn't raise seed in cantaloupes in Imperial Valley because it got so hot that the seed, as it matured in the melon, would sprout within the melon. And so they couldn't produce the seed. So the seed was produced in Rocky Ford, Colorado, which is rather famous for its cantaloupes, and shipped to Imperial Valley, California, and it was planted there. Other than that, I don't really know a whole lot about my mother's parents. They were of Welsh extraction. Other than that, I don't really know a great deal about them.
Did your, when your grandfather, he lived out on the ranch, didn't he? In
my grandfather, Jewel?
Yes.
He spent a lot of time out, basically now in the summer months, we had the place up on Lander Creek, which was the summer home for the family, and that was the basis of operation for the sheep business during the summer months. In the winter months, my grandfather, Jewel, used to spend quite a bit of time at the farm in Farson.
Yes.
He'd go out there. Matter of fact, he was there when he became ill and suddenly died. According to my family tree here, it said he died of stroke. It was either stroke or heart attack. But he became ill while he was up there at Farson on the farm.
Now, there was just you and your brother?
There was one other brother that died at birth. A year after I was born, my parents had another son named Einar, which is a family name. He was born and died on June the 10th, 1928. I was born on May the 9th, 1927. Then I had my older brother, Paul Christopher Jewell Jr., named for my father, who died on the 28th of October, 1989. It seems odd to me at this place in time, you know, when we think of ourselves, we don't too often feel in our minds any older than we did when we were teenagers. And so I don't feel a great deal different in my mind today than I did when I was 18. And here I am, the patriarch of the Jewel family in the state of Wyoming, you know. That's hard for me to believe.
Isn't that? That's interesting, though. Do you remember anything that your parents might have said about their parents when they, what they thought of the country when they first came here, or even your parents? Of course, your parents would naturally, I imagine, like it when they were natives of this part of the country, and they liked the mountains, of course.
My mother, of course, was a native of Rocky Ford, Colorado, and she didn't come to Rock Springs until she and my father were married. They were both going to the University of Colorado in Fort Collins, Colorado. My grandfather, Jewel, when his children, he had four daughters and my father, the only son. When they got up to college age, they moved to Fort Collins, Colorado, bought a home there, and were close to the college there specifically so that the kids could get a college education. This was where my Dad and Mother met was at that college. So she didn't come to Rock Springs until they were married. And her first impression of Rock Springs, I think, was rather grim, according to what I have heard her say. We had some other relatives in town of the O'Donnell family. A brother of my grandmother Jules, Fred O'Donnell, had a home here and a wife and some children. And the first meal my mother ate when she came to Rock Springs, she ate at Uncle Fred's house. And what they served was Finn and Hattie. And my mother had never, ever been confronted with Finn and Hattie prior to that time. And she thought it was absolutely horrible. She thought it was, of all of the uncouth, savage things to serve a newcomer to the town, Finn and Hattie had to be at the top of the list. She didn't like the way it smelled, and she didn't like the way it tasted, and it was just very obnoxious to her, and she was quite outraged about it. In later years, she became the biggest Finn and Hattie fan of the whole family. She dearly loved Finn and Hattie. And as a youngster growing up, we had Finn and Hattie in the wintertime. We didn't buy a whole lot of meat other than what we raised, but we ate Finn and Hattie in the wintertime when it became available. Of course, my grandfather, Chris Jewell, when he had his home in Fort Collins, Colorado, and used to go back and forth basically on the railroad in those days. It was entirely on the railroad because they didn't have automobiles that would travel that distance in those times. So when he was in Rock Springs and not up at Farson, he stayed with my mother and dad in Rock Springs.
I see.
And by reason of his Norwegian taste, they ate a lot of things such as Finn and Hattie. Another thing they ate a lot of were the fish balls made from codfish. Have you ever
eaten those? Yes, I have. Very good.
I have some out in my pantry.
Oh.
My mother used to buy them by the case.
Oh.
But this came through the Norwegian side of the family. We've always been rather proud of our Norwegian heritage. And yet I don't think that basically about all that's Norwegian about me is my name. And my disposition, my wife often refers to me as a bull-headed Norwegian. I don't know if she is referring to me as being a Norwegian and being bull-headed, or being bull-headed by reason of being a Norwegian. But at any rate, that's about me, all about me that is Norwegian. My mother's people, of course, were Welsh. My dad's mother was Irish. Originally, somewhere back in the eons of time, they all came from Scandinavia because the Vikings populated Ireland, England, the British Isles, Wales. All of those people were of Norse extraction, but somewhere way back in time. We have one ancestor that we trace the Norwegian side of the family in Norway. They originally were in Denmark. And the one ancestor that moved to Norway moved there in the 1600s. I can't remember the exact date. I have it written down there somewhere. But about 1624. He moved from Denmark, he migrated from Denmark to Norway and became the jewel in Norway that established all of the Norwegians today that spell their name J-U-E-L originated from that man. The name is still common in Denmark too. Anywhere you see the name spelt that way, they're related to me in some way or another, even though they may be Danish. And this would go back way, way, way back, clear back into the 1300s.
Oh, that's very interesting.
But the Jewel, J-U-E-L, what it means is wheel. That's the family coat of arms. And I assume that somewhere along the line, back, who knows how far back, that the original name, you know, they used to name people according to their trade. Smith, for instance.
Yes. Yes.
They were blacksmiths. Mm-hmm. Baker. Butcher. In Norwegian, it would be slakter. All of those names, people were named according to their trade. So somewhere in the course of time, there were some of the family who were wheelwrights, who made wheels. And that was how the name originated and became the family name. In Norway, and from the standpoint of the Norwegian part of the family, there were many of the people who were farmers and a number of artisans, carpenters, blacksmiths. There's a museum in Oslo that has quite a bit of blacksmith work done by the Juul family over there. My brother went over to Norway 4 or 5 years ago, he and his wife and daughter, and they went to that museum and saw, I gathered from him that it was primarily a museum of Juul work, blacksmith work, forged things. Nonetheless, they were, I have more relatives really in Norway than I do in the United States by quite a bit.
Now there's more of your dad's, how many were there in your dad's family?
There were five, counting him.
Paul Juul.
He had four sisters, two older and two younger. The two younger sisters are still alive. Margaret turned 89 in January, and Doris is about 87. And they live in Fort Collins, Colorado.
Fort Collins. One of your aunts, your dad's sisters, was a school teacher here, wasn't she, at one time?
She taught his sister Alice, which was the next oldest to him, taught home economics in the Rock Springs school system, for probably 30 years, and retired a little bit early. She had rheumatic fever as a child, and it affected her heart, and yet she lived to be 89 years old. The last 12 years, she had several strokes, and while she wasn't completely bedridden, she was right next to it. Her speech was affected. She had a hard time talking and so on, but she lived a ripe old age. Then he had his oldest sister, was an English teacher in Fort Collins, Colorado, and taught sophomore English in Fort Collins till she retired at 65. Then she went on to teach in the parochial school. They were Catholics, and she taught there until she was about 75. His next, the sister next to him on the younger side was Margaret. She was the only one of the sisters that married, and she had one son, Elliot, who was born the same year that I was, just a month later. Her husband was killed in an automobile accident. The boy was born in June, and her husband was killed in an automobile accident in October. They lived in Pueblo at the time, and after her husband was killed, she moved back to her folks' home and lived there for a good many years, then eventually built a home of her own. She also taught school. She was a kindergarten teacher for about 30 years. She taught in the public school system. Then, upon retirement from there, she too taught in the parochial school until she was about 75. She's the one that's 89 now.
Now, where did you and your brother attend school mainly?
In Rock Springs.
In Rock Springs. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you go away to college anywhere?
I went, the first year out of high school, I went to the University of California's Ag School at Davis, California. And what I intended to studied there was veterinary medicine, and I was enrolled in their pre-veterinary medicine curriculum. But I didn't care for the climate there at all. It rained and it was damp and humid, and I've been afflicted all my life with a back problem, which I was born with. And that had me so miserable in that wet climate that I couldn't endure it. So then the next year I went to the University of Wyoming and learned, and that's all I went to college. My brother, when he graduated from high school, went to college at Colorado University in Boulder, Colorado, was drafted into the Navy from there, spent several years in the Navy, and while he was in the Navy, he was ultimately stationed on a LSM ship as the signalman. He took the test to get into an officer's candidate school and passed it and had the recommendation of his captain, so they sent him back to Boulder, Colorado, in the Navy to study.
You and your brother spent quite a bit of time out on the ranches and the farm.
From my earliest memories, in Rock Springs, at the time when I was a child, the house where I grew up, of course, went back to horse and buggy days. And we had a barnyard and a barn on our property right in the middle of town. And in the wintertime, we kept saddle horses there, and we used it as a collecting point for sheep that we culled from the herds if they became crippled or in poor condition. We would take them out and bring them in and hold them in Rock Springs in the barnyard in back of our house until we made a trip up to the farm in Farson, then we'd haul them up to Farson. So from my earliest memories, sheep were in my life. From the time I was 6 years old, we were lambing sheep, and so much in those days was expected of youngsters, and I marvel today that and lament really that the children don't have any more opportunity to learn at home than they do today, because we had responsibilities. Both my father and my brother were afflicted with asthma, hay fever, and they couldn't get around hay or grain at all because it just choked them right down. I was blessed in that I didn't have that, so I got to take care of all the livestock that was in town. And we had chickens and we had sheep and horses and I had some rabbits, and so I took all the care of that. Well, then in the spring, as soon as school was out, I began going out with the sheep when I was about 10. As soon as school was out, we would be basically through with lambing by that time, but still have perhaps 1,000 head of sheep to lamb out. And I would go out and stay with the sheep. The companions that I had, the people I worked with, were all from Old Mexico, and they didn't speak any English. And of course, at that early age, I didn't speak any Spanish, but I learned. If all you hear spoken is a language that's foreign to you, you soon begin to pick things up, a word at a time, a bit at a time, and you make your blunders and you make your mistakes. But I lived with those Mexican people from the time school got out in the spring, which was about the 1st of June, until school reconvened in the fall, which was about the 1st of September. And so by the time I got to be in junior high school, I could speak really pretty decent Spanish. I couldn't read it or write it at that time, but I took it in high school for 2 years, and then the 2 years that I was in college, I also took it. So I learned to read it and write it, and I still can read and write in Spanish, and I can still speak it. I've lost quite a bit of my fluency because I no longer have the opportunity to speak that I did then.
With Spanish people.
With the Spanish people. When I lived and worked with those people, I spoke more Spanish than I did English by a long ways. And so you get, when you're on that basis, you get to where you think in Spanish. You even dream in Spanish. I had a Spanish teacher in high school that said, you'll never get to the place where you don't have to think in English in your mind first what you want to say and then translate it before you say it. And that's not so. After you speak it to the exclusion of everything else for a while, you don't have to translate. You just, it's strange how it comes out, but I could have a Spanish-speaking person here, sitting here, and speak as fluently to them in Spanish as I'm speaking to you in English, without having any problems with translations or anything like that.
I think that's wonderful.
But that's the way to learn it when you're very small.
Yes.
It's easy learned when you're small.
Yes.
I regret that there was no one in my family other than my grandfather that spoke Norwegian.
Oh, yes.
Because I would dearly love to be able to speak Norwegian.
Oh, yes.
In order to really learn it, though, you have to be somewhere where you're having to speak it, and you're having to listen to it,
yes,
to the exclusion of everything else. Then you get the accent, you know.
Yes. Now tell me about your, you mentioned about 1,000 head of sheep that you lambed out. Is that about the size of the herds that your parents?
We normally, our family operation, we ran generally from 6,000 to 7,000 head total numbers of sheep. This would fluctuate according to conditions of range and economics and anything. The normal size for a band of sheep in the wintertime was about 2,500 head to a band. So we'd run two bands of 2,500, which would make 5,000. Then we had some up on the farm in Farson, and we made one smaller herd down here on the desert. In March, we'd cut the bucks out from the herds and any of the poor sheep and that sort of thing and make a small herd with them. And we fed them extra feed, corn or supplements to help them along. But normally, we ran bands of around 2,000. The 1,000 that were left, we used to start to lamb on the 12th of May, and generally by about the first part of June, most of those would be lambed out. Then there would remain anywhere from 1,000 down to 500 or 600 head that we had to lamb yet. When I was a little kid, what my job was, I stayed in a tent with those sheep, and I took care of the ones that were lambing. That is, they had their lambs, and we were right out on the range. No buildings, no corrals, nothing, just sagebrush. The ewes that would at night would have their lambs. In the morning, you'd get up generally about 2:30 in the morning, just as it was beginning to get bare light, and move the sheep that hadn't lambed away from those that had lambed, so that they didn't get mixed up. Then during the day, the sheep would be grazing in an area, and you'd stay there and watch them, and it rained, and it snowed, and it was miserable. But during the day, the lambs that were born, in the evening, you would move the main band that hadn't lambed away from them. So you went along over a path of land and just dropped small bunches of ewes and lambs behind you as you went. Then the Mexican people that I worked with would come along behind me, and they'd make sure that those lambs were mothered up with their mothers. And then gradually, as the lambs got older, they'd take these small bunches and put them together, gradually put them together so that they didn't bum any lambs. If you put too many together too fast, they get all mixed up, and there's inevitably some that lose contact with the mothers and so on. So you lose them. But my job was to take care of the ones that were lambing. And when I first started doing that, one of the Mexicans that I worked with said, now, if you have to help a ewe lamb and you have to pull a lamb, you take this little piece of quarter-inch rope, which we had an abundance of, and you tie that ewe to a piece of sagebrush by a front leg. And he showed me how to do it. And he said, because oftentimes when you have to pull a lamb, the ewe will get up and she's frightened and excited, and she'll run off and leave the lamb, and then the lamb's bummed. So you tie everyone up. So I said, okay, that's fine. So he was gone all day long. He'd come around generally about 9 o'clock at night, and I'd go in and cook something to eat, and he would watch the sheep. Then he'd come out, take my saddle horse, and go in, and he'd eat and do the dishes, and I stayed with the sheep. Well, he came out the first day in the evening, and here there must have been 25 head of sheep tied to sagebrush that I had helped land. And he laughed so hard he pretty near fell off his horse. And he said, you're getting too excited too quick. Give them a little longer time and they'll have most of them on their own. So this is how you learn the sheep business.
Now the lease, what they call a lease down around Rock Springs, did you bring sheep there in the winter?
Yes, this was where we wintered.
Now, how does that work with the lease?
Well, the Rock Springs Grazing Association leases from the Union Pacific Railroad. You know, and going back to the railroad, when they put the railroad through this country as a concession to encourage the building of the railroad, the federal government gave to the Union Pacific Railroad every other section of land checkerboarded over 20 miles either side of the railroad right-of-way. This was given to the Union Pacific Railroad. So you have a checkerboard of every other section UP land. The land in between...
Now that is federal land, then.
The land that wasn't owned by the Union Pacific Railroad was then owned by the federal government, commonly referred to as BLM land, Bureau of Record. What is BLM? Bureau of Land Management. So, people that formed the Rock Springs Grazing Association each had shares in this, what was called the Rock Springs Lease. The land was leased from the UP Railroad and the federal government, and each share in this lease entitled the owner to run so many head of sheep on this lease for a given period of time during the winter months. Back in the early days, the lease opened the 15th of December, and we had to be off of it, I believe, by the 1st of May. Maybe it was the 15th, but in the spring. But everybody was off by that time anyway.
Now you would take the sheep, trail them, you nearly always trailed them to the mountains for the summer, and that had to be a rite, some kind of a rite that you
were... In the early days, when my grandfather started the sheep business, there was no Taylor Grazing Act, there was no Bureau of Land Management, there was no National Forest Service. Anybody could go anywhere they wanted to with anything they wanted to. In the early days, there used to be sheep came down into this country that originated in Oregon. Back in those days, wool was of enough value, and of course we're talking about pennies per pound, but in those days, a penny was a lot of money. And they used to run bands of wether sheep, male sheep, just for the wool. They'd come down into this country from up in Oregon and end up down on the Union Pacific Railroad and shear. This is where they used to shear at Bitter Creek. There was a big shearing shed there where the John Hay family sheared for years. There was another big shearing shed down at Wamsutter. And in the early days, those people would shear down here, but they could go anywhere they wanted. So in the early days, when my family, my grandfather, took the sheep to the mountains, there were no allotments. There was no restrictions. You could go wherever you wanted. And they got into confrontations with the cattlemen from up in the Pinedale and Boulder country. And my grandfather was in the sheep business at the time of the sheep and cattle wars of that area. He had sheep in the mountains the summer that it finally broke out into violence. The cattlemen raided a bunch of sheep, and I can't remember who they belonged to. That they named the lake where they were Raid Lake as a result of that, and they killed a band of sheep there, the cattlemen did, a whole band. They clubbed a whole band of sheep to death there. They, I believe, killed one of the men that was with them and beat the other one up and tied him onto a horse and turned him loose. My grandfather had his sheep a bit southeast of there at that time, and to avoid getting into that confrontation, he crossed over the Wind River Mountains on both Haley's Pass and Washakie Pass. Haley was a man who was employed by him with the sheep at that time, and that's how Haley's Pass got to be named, was from the sheep herder that first went over that pass with my grandfather's sheep. His intention when he crossed the Wind Rivers, this would have been on to the lander side or the eastern side of the Wind Rivers, his intent was to work back down into southwestern Wyoming in the Rock Springs area on the east side of the Wind River Mountains to avoid the conflict on the west side. But the federal government got involved and resolved that situation to where it was safe to come back, so he came back over those passes with the sheep in the fall and migrated down through Big Sandy Opening, which was the area that he went into, and thus established a use pattern that was followed until the National Forest Service took over, at which time allotments were made to the people who were running sheep up there, and he established those two allotments on the eastern side of the Wind Rivers, which were in a different national forest once they established the national forest. This side, the western slope of the Wind Rivers, is in the Bridger National Forest. The eastern slope is in the, I believe they call it the Washakie National Forest now. It used to be the Shoshone, but it's on that side of the mountain. But that was how those allotments were established. But we used to summer up there from about mid-July until mid-September. And a lot of it was up in very high altitudes, up above timberline, a lot of it. Very cold, wet. And you wondered what in the world sheep would find to eat up there, but they did well enough, except that the insects were terrible. The mosquitoes and the flies were about like you'd experience on the Alaskan tundra. They just were terrible. Mm-hmm. I used to, summering up there with the sheep, I carried a can of sheep dip, which smells pretty rank, and I'd mix that up and souse my horses down with it to try to give them some relief from the biting insects. They were terrible on horses. And they were kind of rough on people, too, but I felt sorry for the livestock in those conditions. It was horrible.
Did the law finally come in and settle the sheep and cattle wars that they had up there?
The federal government did.
Uh-huh. I had heard quite a lot about it, but I didn't know exactly.
But they finally resolved it. They finally, and I believe it was at this time that they pretty much established the national forest and use rights and allotments and so on. They allocated what land was to be used by the sheep people, what land was to be used by the cattle people, and so on.
What were some of the other names of the sheep people that were up in that country about the same time that your parents and your grandfather had?
Well, going back to when my grandfather was there, I can't really tell you. The Arambell family, of course, was there when I was young. The Arambell family, the Armosby family, the Bob Jack family, the Spicer family, the John Hay family. John Hay family ran a vast number of sheep up in that country. In the early days, the Poston family, the house that Dave Utzinger lives in Rock Springs today, right across the street from John Hay's house, that was originally built and owned by Lon Poston.
I see.
They were good friends of my grandparents and of my family. They moved to Lander. Uh-huh.
And then the Lackey,
Lackey Roberts
owned that after
bought that.
Lackey Roberts, uh-huh.
But it was originally owned by a family by the name mm-hmm. of Poston. Lon and Ada Poston.
Now about your family a little bit. How did you happen to meet your wife?
Well, I, of course, grew up in Rock Springs. In 1949, I started living up in Farson in the wintertime. That was a rough winter. And we had a lot to do, a lot of feeding. And I started to live up there. I liked Eden Valley and I liked Farson. And of course my family had the farm there that was leased to Floyd Henry for many years. So I started living up there. My brother pretty much ran the sheep outfit from the standpoint of the herds, but I stayed up there and took care of that end of it. And I met my wife in 1952, which was a kind of a hard winter too. Back in those days, we had some winter. The snow was deep. And we met through your sister, Marjorie. We had known each other for a number of years and known who we were, who one another was, at any rate, but never had any association with each other. So when we met, it was in February, and spring fall was coming along in April, and I didn't think I had too much time to do much courting, because I figured as soon as the snow went off, my wife would escape. She wasn't my wife yet, but so we started going together in February, and 5 weeks later, we were married. We went together 5 weeks. Well,
the latter part of February
when we started going together, and we were married the 7th of April. Actually, we went together all of March and the first week of April.
Okay.
It was a very long courtship. Now, that seems kind of quick. We didn't have to get married either.
You're not putting that on tape.
Why not?
That's on tape. That's on tape.
You're racist.
You forget that I'm a Norwegian and I'll say what I want to say. At any rate, on the 7th of April this year, 1992, we will have been married 40 years. And for having only courted for 5 weeks, that's pretty good, in my opinion. You know, I see people that go together for years and years and years and don't do quite that well. So,
had a very fine family.
Begotten and delivered 5 children, and they're all grown and they're all responsible people. We have 11 grandchildren and enjoy all of them. We lived in Farson for several years after we were married. Then we My family sold out the ranching business and we moved down to Fort Collins, Colorado. I lived there for 9 years and I didn't know anything other than ranch work when I moved away from it. And I had butchered a lot of sheep when I was growing up. And I knew a little something about that, so I got employment as a butcher. And I slaughtered then for 9 years down in Colorado and 1 year back up in Wyoming again. We came back to Wyoming and finally became allergic to something in the industry, the blood or the hair or something. And went back to farming, just working for other people. And ultimately I starved out at that and went to work at the FMC Corporation in 1973 and went on medical retirement from them some years later. I didn't know when I first went out there and looking for employment, I looked down into all that vast amount of machinery and huge, huge place. And I thought, oh my, I wonder if I'll ever be able to learn enough about that to make a living at it. I was just, you know, well, 5 years later, I was a production supervisor in that plant and responsible on the off shifts, on the swing shift in the graveyard, for running that whole plant.
Now this was at FMC?
This was at FMC.
You sold the ranch to Hod Sanders, didn't you?
We sold the farm in Farsi.
The farm, yes.
To Hod Sanders. We sold the sheep outfit to the McGagna brothers and to the Armbell family. But the sheep business, we lived very much like the Arabs do over in Arabia. We were nomads. We followed the sheep with the seasons. In the wintertime, we were as far south in our swing as we'd get down in this country. In the summertime, in midsummer, we'd be as far north as we'd get, up on the other side of the Wind River Mountains. Then in the fall, we moved down out into what's called the Little Colorado Desert, Sublet Spring. We stayed there until the Rock Springs lease opened up in December, moved down here. Stayed here until about the 1st of April, then migrated back up to area below Lander Creek, below Prospect in the old Elkhorn area. And spent the spring there, lambed the sheep there, then migrated on up into the higher country for the summer. And we did that annually. It was just, home was wherever you unrolled your bed at night.